So here we are. Welcome, everybody. Week three of this session, which is session seven. So I hope that you're enjoying the way that we're moving through this section of knowledge of time and space, the time section of knowledge of time and space. This is the first time, I believe, that we've actually gone just straight through from the beginning of a section in one book all the way through. And there's something I think very valuable in that because, at least for me as I do that, because you really start to see how everything holds together, how there are themes that are working themselves out over time. So we have some themes, and I want to take a few minutes to lay out some of those themes, which actually extend back into the previous session, in which we've been discussing throughout. So this is kind of a summary. And then that will lead us into an exercise. So, in the orientation, I quoted something from Dynamics of Time and Space. The quote was, "There are countless special places where awareness of time can open into knowledge." So, one of the key ideas in the TSK vision, it seems to me, is that we have lost our connection to time and space. And as a result, we have a very limited form of knowledge, of understanding. And the vision is meant to activate or you know, reintroduce us, make friends with, maybe you could say, time and space. And another way of saying that is meant to help us become aware of time and space. The problem, of course, is that space becomes, in our ordinary understanding, just an emptiness, just the container for objects, for things, whether those are mental things or physical things. Which means that space disappears. It's just an emptiness. There's nothing there. And time becomes frozen. And we'll say a little bit more about that today. Because there is a dynamic, there is a momentum to time, but it's a subjective momentum. And otherwise, time becomes this force that is just bearing down on us. But we don't have any real connection to it. So we'd like to cultivate an awareness of time. And as in that quotation, it says an awareness of time can open into knowledge. So it can open into a different kind of knowledge, a different kind of understanding. So how do we do that? Well, we've been looking at various ways to do that. I want to run through a few of them. So the first, and this goes back to the previous session when we were looking at dynamics of time and space, and that section at page 100, which I just quoted from, and actually page 99, there is an exercise we work with there. It's not formally presented as an exercise, but it simply had to do with tuning in to the arising of each moment in time. You know, we situate ourselves at the point where time, where the future comes into being. And that place, you can say, is where we discover the dynamic of time. So that's in a way the most direct way. It's also, you could say, it's challenging. Suni, by the way, says that she thinks that she points to a post on the web that Caroline made, Orchestra of. And she says that's relevant to this. So by all means, I invite you, and useful. So by all means, I invite you to take a look at that. Now, that kind of awareness of the immediate dynamic of time, just going to it, just saying, well, in each moment, experience, and reality arise, and you can just welcome that arising in each moment. That's as I say, it's maybe the most direct way of engaging the arising of time. In that same portion, that same place in dynamics, there's a discussion of other ways to arrive or to discover the dynamic of time, places that are just alive in a kind of special way. So those might be agitation. It might be a kind of special experience that catches you up. It might be the stream of thoughts, if you really can engage the stream. I think it's pretty clear what's being pointed at in these examples. It's moments where the kind of onrushing quality of time becomes immediately available. The same thing perhaps happens when you're in a dangerous situation. Everything becomes clear in a very different way. So that possibility too. And that's related to something that we discussed in the last class, which was that you can experience the dynamic of time in moments of beauty, in moments, the kind of archetypal situation is when you say time stood still. And somewhat surprisingly, when you say time stood still, in those moments, you're in touch with the dynamic of time, but it doesn't move in the usual way. So that's another possibility. Now, there's another example, which I think takes us a little closer to some of what's being said in this chapter and to the exercise that we're going to do also. But it's very much related to the examples I've just been giving. And that is the precision of the order. So by the order, I mean the temporal order and what's referred to in this chapter, but also in other places that we've talked about, the logos, which is that kind of temporal order, the way in which things fit together, the way in which things make sense. And it's getting clear on how everything gets specified by the order that gives us a way in, or gives us another way in to the dynamic of time. And the exercise from last week, the extra exercise that I mentioned, was an attempt to really explore that possibility of specification, of making things more and more specific. And we focused on the past, because the past in a way is easier as an object. It's something to engage. So a past situation, and you look at how you try to make it as specific as possible. You can do that in the present too. You can do that at any time. And the very fact of specificity, of precision, is itself an activity of time. And that is actually, I think, really, really important in terms of what's being presented here in Knowledge of Time and Space with respect to time. That so in the orientation, I talked about specificity. But I think probably a better way to talk about it is specification. When you specify, it's not, you don't exactly discover time in the specifics, in the things that you specify. It's more in the activity of specifying, in the specification as an activity. You could say it's a kind of measuring out. And one of the points that gets made again and again, really, in these readings in Knowledge of Time and Space, is that time is responsible for measuring out and for specifying. And I actually want to read you just a quick mention of that. It's right at the end of our reading for this week. At the very top of page 46, he says, the force of time, you could say for our purposes, the dynamic of time, the force of time manifests in the established order. So in what's been established, in the order of what's been established, the logic of it, the way it all fits together. The force of time manifests in the established order through a momentum whose thrust and directionality are pre-established. So we already know how the order is going to unfold. It's pre-established. But there is still the momentum of its unfolding. So entering into relation with this pre-established momentum, and this is not some special exercise, he's describing this as something that we do all the time. Entering into relation with this pre-established momentum activates the potential for roles, models, meanings, value, and purpose. So all of these things that play a part in our lives, roles and models, this is on the subjective side, you could say. Roles, models, meanings, value, purpose, those all become available through the specifying momentum of time. And it goes on. It makes possible units of measurement, transitions, sequence, measurement itself, and calculation. It provides for birth and death, growth, control, formulation, and responsibility. For the given human subject, time lets information be projected from the objective to the subjective realm. Well, I'll stop there, but this notion of specifying that time gives us that power. You know, if you say space is completely open, so in space, in a certain sense, nothing has ever happened and nothing does ever happen. Things show up, and I'm not going to try to go into all that because we've spent a lot of time on that in the past. But with time, you get this specification. All the precision of our experience shows up. So Klaus asks, is this specification the same that is aimed for in visualization? And that's very interesting. Yes, I think it is very much connected. So when you, the exercise last week in the orientation was to remember something from your past, your fairly distant past, some place, and try to specify it as much as possible. Well, that is basically a visualization. And for those of you who do practice with visualizations in the Buddhist context or some other context, I would say that, yes, that ability to specify, which is a part of visualization, it's not all of it, but that's very much related to what we're talking about. Yes. Okay, so that's the specification. And that's where we're going to go in an exercise in a minute. Now, I do want to point out the final way, you could say, of activating the dynamic of time that we've been looking at is a more meditative approach. And that's really what we were doing in the assigned exercises for this week. So the assigned exercise was dynamics, in dynamics exercise 13. And then also I asked you to kind of look at that in the light of or integrate that with exercise 24 in time, space, and knowledge, marriage of sound and breath, which you're all familiar with. I think what's being suggested is that if you take this more meditative approach, and by that I mean something pretty simple, I mean just kind of a slowing down. If you let go of your usual concerns and preoccupations, so with respect to sound, for instance, instead of automatically naming everything and letting that be the focus, naming everything that produces a sound, you know, the car going by, like that. If instead you just let the sound be there as the sound, and the naming is not so important, then you settle, then the momentum, you could say, which just drives us on into the next moment, settles down, slows down, there's a kind of a relaxation. And in that relaxed mode, time opens up. And that's what exercise 13 is very much about. So what happens in the meditative approach is you let go of the concerns of the self. I think that's very much one of the key things, let's say, that meditation is ordinarily about. there's a kind of a very natural set of concerns and preoccupations and worries and desires that the self has. And in meditation, you can loosen that up. And Sudhi comments on that. She says, in both of the exercises, so the two assigned exercises, the specifications diffused, allowing for more diffused points to show up. Yeah, I think that's right. I think you may mean, Sudhi, diffused. Diffuse is when you take the tension out of something, and that actually applies also. So maybe that is what you mean. But if I think about exercise 13, one way to describe that would be a kind of diffusion, where the usual very precise specification, as you say, loosens and opens. Diffuse meaning not focused sharply, right? I think that's diffused, maybe. Anyway, I think at this point we're clear on what you meant, and I think that's right. It's in a way a meditative approach is just the opposite of a specification approach. But we're going to have a chance to look at that now, because I actually want us to do a kind of a specification approach, and the reason for that is that I don't think for a while now we've been doing the assigned exercise for the week. We've been doing that for a few minutes in the phone call, but when the exercises have this kind of meditative quality, I think it's difficult to really get into them enough in the course of just 4 or 5 minutes to really be able to engage them. And so I thought, rather than trying to do that, we would do an exercise which is more like a specification exercise. And I'm taking it from the reading in light of what we've been saying about specification. It's on page 45. And it makes this distinction. So it's the second full paragraph. I think we can just read the paragraph by itself. It says, when time is consigned to the background, in other words, our usual understanding of time, what happens, seasons pass and the calendar advances and so on. When time is consigned to the background, it serves chiefly as a device for measuring out the passage of events. So that's that specification. So you could talk about a temporal measuring out, like 10 o'clock, 11 o'clock, 12 o'clock, or you could talk about measuring out in a whole variety of ways in connection with the temporal order. That's what we've been talking about a little bit this morning. So that's the background, or the time is a background. It becomes a device for measuring out. Yet subject knowing object, and I don't think we need any background there. He's just taking that example. Subject knowing object is an act that communicates energy and movement born of the dynamic of time. And then he says, time could more accurately be considered a fundamental force. But for us, the key sentence is that one that says, subject knowing object is an act that communicates energy and movement born of the dynamic of time. So what I take that to mean, what I understand that to mean, and what I'd like us to practice with, is that when we engage an object, so it could be through perception, that's probably the easiest way, but it might also be in memory, or it might be a thought considered as an object. Anything that comes up, there is this exchange or this dynamic or relationship. The subject knows the object. And the point here is to focus on the dynamic of knowing. So usually we just take that for granted, right? We just know what's been identified, what's been measured out. So I look in front of me and I see a clock, and I know that's a clock, and that's what's important to me, is the identity that I assign it, and maybe my the field within which that clock appears, that's a way that we've explored that in the past. But here what we're saying is that in order for me to know the clock, this is going to sound really obvious, there has to be an activity of knowing. And whatever our experience, there is also the act of knowing which makes that experience available to us. So the practice that's suggested by that sentence is to be aware of the dynamic of the act of knowing. You could also say the act of specifying. Right? So it's very different, or a very different approach from the kind of meditative approach, but it's very much related to this kind of precision. So the act of measuring out, ordinarily we just focus on what's been measured out, what's been identified. But there's also the act. There's also the activity of knowing. So the subject knowing the object, which is in a way the most fundamental thing we can say about our experience. As a subject, once we've stepped into the duality of subject and object, which we've always done, the subject knows the object, and that act of the subject knowing the object, that activity, is a place to discover the dynamic of time. So the very act of specifying. So I hope that's clear. Let's try it for a few minutes, okay? Yes. No. Okay. Just one more object to know. Okay, well, let's come back together. And as always, I'll invite you to share some of what you noticed. I'll switch back into chat view here. Okay. Caroline raises a nice point here. She says, the more I do these time exercises, the more I come to wonder what is the difference in meaning between the word time and the word life. So I'm going to respond to that in a couple of ways. I think it's great to point to the connection, certainly, between time and life. And I think that when you become aware of time, or when you activate the time dimension, let's say, of the TSK vision, then it is a question of time coming alive. And you can really say, yes, time is inseparable from life. The one thing maybe that I would say on the other side is that it's important to be tuned in to the fact that what appears to us as ordinarily, you could say, lifeless, so let's say the objective world, the clock that we see, that's part of my living experience. And if you only say life, then I think the tendency might be to leave that out. But I think that if you go to a deeper level, yes, you know, experience is alive, and that aliveness is temporal, is time. I think that seems right to me. John says, specifying is like a freezing into experience, like a snapshot of a moving river. The dynamic of time is the river or ocean, and specificity is the self's way of experiencing the ocean by freezing it. Okay, so there are several very interesting things there. First of all, I think the word freezing is a good word to have available as we think about what what are we talking about? It's the opposite, you could say, of the aliveness of time, even though we don't usually put alive and frozen in contrast, but seems good enough right now. So yes, we do tend to freeze time, and the way that time gets frozen is into this temporal order, which gets specified. And the point of some of what we've been talking about, and perhaps something that you were able to explore in this exercise, is that when you've frozen something, it isn't really frozen at all. The very act of freezing, you could say, through specifying, is itself the aliveness of time. And you can rediscover it, because in every moment you're specifying. In every moment you're confirming or affirming what is really so. So it's a little bit like if you think about the creation of the universe, you'd say, well, there was this moment at the beginning of time when the universe came into being, this tremendous act of creation, and then it was over, you know, and everything that's happened since then is just the working out, the specification of what happened in that first moment of time. This is a view, it's a very extreme view of determinism, which would say everything has already been established, right? In that first moment of specification. But from the point of view of, you know, that we're looking at now, it doesn't make sense to specify an original moment in which something creative happens. Something gets specified or gets called into existence, and then say everything else is just the frozen consequence of that. That act of creation is ongoing. We're always involved. You know, it's only because we think of things in terms of past and present and future and the source from which something comes that the temptation is to say the aliveness of time is only in the first moment of action. No, the aliveness of time is always available, even within what's been specified. And that really is one of the key points that I'm trying to point to here want to make sure we're clear on, that that time is always available, and the aliveness of time is always available. And we can discover it in something as simple as the act of knowing. Okay, let's take a look. There's a lot more things that people have been commenting on here. Ken says, how is it that being aware of can shift out of retrospective mode? How does time play a role in this shift? Is it to be found in time's presence? No, he says time's preness. Oh, preness, okay. Okay, let's go on. Of course, space is both pre and post. The sinking in quality of specificity bears the liveliness of time and space. The measuring out welcomes and is welcomed by the immeasurable. Well, that last phrase is very nice, and I think points towards what we've been talking about. The measuring out welcomes and is welcomed by the immeasurable. So the immeasurable remains accessible within what's been measured out. There's a somewhat more mundane way of saying that. So yeah, specificity has this quality, you call it the sinking in quality here, of being the bearer or the carrier. That's a term that Rinpoche uses in these chapters at some points. Whatever shows up is a carrier of the dynamic of time. Okay. And Eliana says, in the act of knowing, there is a drive toward the object in order to do something with it, to name, to connect it with other names I know, to relate to stories I know, etc. It is like I need to control it. If I bring the subject-object reversal exercise, I'm able to shift and feel the quality of the object, its energy. Well, that's nice. That would be a very nice way of working with this, kind of integrating in that sense of the object not having been already specified. I'm going to rephrase this now in the terms that we're talking about now. The object hasn't already been specified and frozen, but the object and the whole experience of subject knowing object is, again, a manifestation of the aliveness of time. And your point, Eliana, is a very good one, that one of the reasons you could say that it always seems frozen in advance is that we only engage the object, we only approach the object in order to use it. So we've already, you know, things are kind of pre-frozen, and maybe that's related to Ken's point about time ordinarily involves the pre. I'm not sure I'm using the term in the way you have in mind, Ken, but let's assume I am. There's always something set up in advance. But if you go to the setting up, then you realize it isn't set up in advance. That's just based on the past, present, future structure. The setting up is something that's ongoing right now. And the past, present, future structure is a part of what's being set up and what's going on right now. Okay. So shifting to the energy of the object, Eliana, I think that's very much in line with what we're talking about here. Michael says, focusing on the activity of knowing feels more like being in the surf. He says that as a landlocked New Mexican, but I guess you remember. Focusing on the activity of knowing feels more like being in the surf, whereas going straight to what is known is like picking up shells washed up on shore. Okay, that's nice and ties in very nicely with what John said about the ocean, right? As opposed to what's frozen. But I like the image. Yeah, it seems you could say, I think somewhere in the TSK books, Rinpoche talks about always looking at the footprints that have been left behind by experience instead of just going right to experience. And that's much more like this. You know, we do want to go to the aliveness of time. I'm using that term a lot now. I think it's fine. And the activity of knowing is one way to do that. Or the way I was talking about it at the beginning today was more like the activity of specifying. And then it's the aliveness. It's not like, you know, walking along the shore looking for what's been cast up, you know, all the leftovers. Sudhi says, when I focused more on the relationships of object that appears with the knowing that is happening. Let me start that again. When I focused more on the relationships of object that appears with the knowing that is happening. Okay, so there's a knowing and it's related to an object. The more fluid and non-ending perspectives appear. I'm editing a little here. I hope I'm getting that right. Unlike the usual way of subject concluding a perspective on the appeared object. Yeah, the distinction, if I understand that, that's exactly the point. The subject has measured everything up, you know, in relationship to the object. And now we're talking about something that's much more fluid because it's ongoing. It's this active knowing. And Caroline asks, I don't understand what Ken wrote. How is it that being aware of can shift out of retrospective mode? Well, she quotes Ken, and then she says, Ken, maybe you could say a little more. So I'm going to leave you to say a little more because I'm not sure I understand either. I could take a guess, but Ken's the right person. While that's going on, I'm going to move forward a little bit, though. I want to make at least one more basic point, and because I had said I was going to share the desktop, I'm actually going to share the desktop. To show you something, but I have to say something first. So there's a, you know, among the many points that get made in the reading, there's this suggestion made at the very beginning of the reading that time is the projection of a particular awareness. This is in the second paragraph on page 31. And then it goes on to say the reality of linear time is only an aspect of this projection. We've already talked about that a little bit. While not false, it could be described as illusory. Now, this is the distinction that Rinpoche makes in different ways at various times in the TSK books. You don't have to say that something is false, for instance, linear time. Things do operate in accordance with linear time. You know, we started this class about 40 minutes ago, and we'll end it in about 10 minutes, something like that. All that has to do with linear time. It's not false. In what sense is it illusory, then? It's that it doesn't have the reality that it claims to have. So linear time, in our ordinary understanding, and time is a great example because everybody just takes it for granted. In our ordinary time, we say, okay, past, present, future. That's the way things are. Things come out of the past, and then they're in the present for just a moment, and then they go on to the future. We all know that. That's the way things are. It's real. It's true. We're absolutely convinced of it. Whatever our experience is, it has to conform to it. And the notion of this being illusory is that it's not real in that sense. It just all goes along with a particular orientation. It all goes along with the logos or the order, which is something that gets talked about here and which we've looked at quite a bit in past sessions also, right? So I want to play you now a video, if I can figure out how to do this, I've actually mentioned it in classes in the past, and it finally occurred to me that it probably is on YouTube, and it is. So I'm going to play it, and hopefully while I play it, you'll still hear my voice. I'm not actually sure that that's going to be the case, but let's try. Okay, it's only 1 minute or so long. Okay, so I'm going to open this up. There it is over there in the corner. I will make it bigger, and it's okay that we're missing the first few seconds. Can you hear me all right? Can somebody speak up? Okay, good. Thank you. So what we're looking at, let me make this bigger, is what's called the trapezoid window illusion. So this is a window. It's actually a piece of cardboard or whatever in the shape of a trapezoid, not our usual rectangular window. And the thing to notice is that you'll see right here, the window has just started moving, say, from direction of left to right. And you'll see it's turning from left to right, and now it's going to come to a point where it stops and turns around and goes from right to left. Now, all of that is an illusion. The window, that shape, it looks like a window, doesn't change directions at all. It's always going in one direction. And that's why they put the stick here in this particular version, because if you just watch the stick instead of the window, you'll see that the stick keeps going in the same direction the whole time. So, okay, that's the end of it. I think that's good enough. So let me go back to chat. Okay. Okay, so we have chat back. Let me get the end sharing. Where's that? Stop sharing. Okay. Okay. So the reason I played that little image is because the only reason that we see the window as changing directions is that we have a certain expectation. And the expectation is that the window is square, and then given the shape, and I'll post this, I think, on the website, this, if you want to look at it some more, or those of you who are not connected on the computer can take a look at it. We have this certain understanding of what it is that we're seeing, and based on that understanding, we interpret what we see in a particular way. So I think that's very much related to what Rinpoche says here, the very first sentence in the reading: the truth of experience seems inextricably intertwined with the projections of awareness. So we project the way things are, and we do that in accord with an order, a specific order. And having projected it in that way, then we accept that as the truth of experience. That is the illusion. The illusion is that's the way things are. It's not that, it's kind of funny because we call this an illusion, this particular trapezoid window illusion, but it's not an illusion that we see the window turn, one direction and then the other. That's the truth of our experience. The illusion is because we're expecting something. And that is exactly, that's the same thing as what Rinpoche is saying when he says that linear time and the reality. Whoops, sorry, that shouldn't, that's the sound of the video, which should be off now. Let me turn it off. Where is it? It is off. Okay. Anyway, that's the illusion. So linear time, in that sense, is an illusion. And we can go beneath or beyond it. And that's part of what we've been exploring the whole time today. Now, I want to give you one specific example just to try to make this a little more concrete. There's a whole lot more that could be said about our reading, but that's too bad. We don't have time for that. So I want to give an example that I'd like to make very concrete, and that is that a situation in which you're feeling emotional. So you're angry, or you're upset, or you're unhappy, or you're disappointed. I'm going with negative emotions because I think in some ways they're easier to work with. So if you say, well, what is the relationship of that emotion to time? And if we understand linear time to be illusory in the sense that we were just talking about, does that have any impact on our experience of the emotion? Well, there are various ways to look at that. I want to just cover them quickly. Three in particular, and the third is the one that I want to focus on because it's related to what we have been talking about today. So first you could say, well, in order for the emotion to happen at all, there has to be time, right? An emotion unfolds in time. We're constantly feeling emotional, creating that emotional state, you could say. So if time stood still, or if time were somehow very different, the emotion couldn't really exist. But that's just kind of a logical possibility for now. Or logical point. The second thing I want to say is that any emotion has a kind of emotional charge to it. And when we're talking about the charge, we're talking about an energy. And that energy is more related to the dynamic of time. So if you saw, or if you were more tuned in to the dynamic of events unfolding, or to the emotion unfolding, the content of the emotion would become, let's say, secondary. You just see how from moment to moment, that's a linear way of talking, but still, from moment to moment, the emotion was the manifestation of a certain energy in the field as a whole, you could say. That would be a way of working with emotion from a temporal perspective. And then the third example, and the one I want to focus on, I think we've already prepared the way for it, and that is that in order for the emotion to show up as an emotion, so it's always going to be a question of my emotion, right? I feel angry. I feel upset. In order for that to happen, there has to be this whole order, this temporal order or logos, which centers on the I. Here I am, and something happened to me. There's a story we're telling, and now I feel upset, something like that. And if we understand how that emotion is being set up as a part of an order in a kind of a whole. So we've talked a lot about the field of the whole for space, but now we're talking about the whole in kind of temporal terms, the whole order of the logos. If we see the emotion as an outcome or a manifestation or expression of that temporal order in which I am emotional about this, let's say, and if we see that specification being set up, and it's being set up right now, it's not being set up any other time, it's not that we once had the experience in the past of starting to feel angry, and now we're just feeling the consequences of that going forward in time. No, it's always being set up. The order, the act of specification is the aliveness of time in that emotional reaction. And if we go to that aliveness of time, not focusing on the content, the specific emotion, then I think the emotion can shift, it will shift in a very natural way. So you might want to look at that, and I'm going to in fact suggest that as the walkabout for the week to try to remember to look at that at times when you are feeling some kind of an emotion. Okay, that's what we can do today. Ken did answer Caroline's question, and I'm not going to go into it now. It'll be posted on the website, right? He talks about the retro, the pre, and the refined. He does say, the essential activity is space blossoming. And maybe we could think of that blossoming as an expression of the dynamic of time that's available to us. Okay, let's stop there. Thank you very much.